in the acceptance kids. Combien de temps?
J'en sais rien. Tu sais, t'as un truc rouge là-bas. Tu vas bien.
Tu veux dire l'heure? Ouais. Mais alors, moi, si tu veux, j'ai un problème. Soit j'enlève mes lunettes, et je me mets là. Soit je me mets les lunettes, je
vais bien. Tu veux que je te
dise? C'est trop long. J'ai pas dit bonjour à Patrick.
J'ai l'avantage du handicap. J'ai un strabisme. J'ai pas de strabisme. J'ai un œil qui voit de près. Un
voit de loin.
Parce que tu vois, 19h, ils sont très à l'heure, hein, parce que tu vois, à 19h29-35, tout le monde a baissé.
De quoi?
A baissé les...
La voix?
Ouais. C'est presque
celui-là.
Oui,
tu veux que j'aille voir? Oui, ici, il est, comme il est 19h57, 29.
Personne qui rentre, donc c'est
vrai
toujours...
problème.
Je sens qu'on va me faire les reproches de commencer à l'heure. Il n'y a plus personne qui rentre. Oui. Merci Geneviève.
Il faudrait des ouvreurs ou des ouvreuses pour dire aux gens d'aller.
Ah oui, au milieu.
Au
là.
Milieu. Ouais, tu vois, c'est dommage.
Ouais. Chers amis, nous allons commencer ce soir cette cérémonie de remise du prix international de la Fondation Ficen à Sylvia Arbor, qui est à mes côtés. Et je vais vous dire, il y a deux circonstances particulières ce soir. La première, c'est que je ne sais pas si vous voyez, nous sommes trois femmes. Et c'est bien la première fois, sans doute, que... À cette tribune, nous avons trois femmes, ce qui prouve que les femmes sont capables d'apporter quelque chose à la science. La deuxième chose que je voudrais vous rappeler, c'est que ce sont les 40 ans de la Fondation Ficen cette année et que nous devons nous retrouver une nouvelle fois le 17 mai au Collège de France pour fêter tous ensemble les 40 ans de cette fondation et les idées de M. Ficen quand il a institué cette fondation. Alors... Promouvoir sous toutes ses formes l'analyse scientifique des mécanismes logiques du comportement animal et humain et leur développement ontogénique et phylogénétique était le but de M. Ficen et c'est ce que nous continuons à faire aujourd'hui. La Fondation s'intéresse donc aux capacités de raisonnement et plus largement aux processus cognitifs ainsi qu'aux fondements biologiques et culturels de ces processus et finance plusieurs disciplines et nous avons parmi vous ce soir des représentants de toutes ces disciplines, les neurosciences, l'éthologie, la psychologie, l'anthropologie, l'archéologie et la paléontologie. Et la Fondation donc, aide ces disciplines à travers plusieurs programmes que je vais vous rappeler, car c'est mon rôle, comme l'année dernière, de vous redire un petit peu à quel moment vous pouvez nous demander de l'aide pour vos recherches. La première action de la Fondation, c'est l'attribution d'allocations postdoctorales pour permettre à nos étudiants de partir à l'étranger pour se former ou d'accueillir dans nos laboratoires des titulaires de doctorat pour travailler avec nous sur nos thèmes. Les candidats sont sélectionnés par le comité scientifique et l'excellence scientifique et l'innovation sont bien sûr au cœur de notre sélection des candidats. La Fondation a maintenant plus de 1000 chercheurs qui ont bénéficié de son soutien et qui ont la plupart des postes dans les laboratoires français et étrangers. La deuxième action de la Fondation, c'est l'allocation de subventions de recherche pour des jeunes chercheurs de moins de 40 ans et déjà en poste pour développer leurs projets, toujours évidemment dans les objectifs de la Fondation et cette fois-ci en France. Troisième action, les colloques internationaux qui permettent de réunir environ une trentaine de chercheurs français et étrangers sur des thèmes de la Fondation et qui donnent lieu à la publication d'un ouvrage. Et le colloque de cette année qui aura lieu, ça ne m'est pas précisé, s'appelle « Enacting Social Memory, Cognition, Image Making and Ritual Action » sous la direction de Carlo Severi, directeur d'études à l'École des hautes études en sciences sociales et membre du laboratoire d'anthropologie sociale du Collège de France. Colloques internationaux, mais aussi séminaires FICEN, qui sont plus réduits, puisque ça s'adresse à un petit groupe de chercheurs, avec souvent d'anciens boursiers FICEN, qui se réunissent un ou deux jours sur un thème de la Fondation. Ce type de projet est organisé par un membre du Conseil scientifique, et donc nous permet de nous retrouver ensemble, en croisant les disciplines, pour débattre et travailler. En 2018, nous avons eu un séminaire organisé conjointement par Sonia Garel, que je n'ai pas présenté tout à l'heure, qui est directrice de recherche à l'Institut de biologie de l'École normale supérieure, et qui tout à l'heure remettra à Sylvia son prix. Mais en octobre 2018, je crois, c'était avec Nathalie Rouache et Rosa Cossard, vous avez organisé un séminaire sur New Insight into Neuroglial Communication. Cinquième point, les annales de la Fondation FICEN, qui rassemblent les articles rédigés par les boursiers, après sélection par un comité de lecture composé de personnalités scientifiques, qui permettent la reconnaissance des travaux de recherche qui ont été financés, notamment par nos postdocs. Vous pouvez les voir et vous pouvez les télécharger sur le site internet de la Fondation. Et je rappelle que le site de la Fondation est vraiment remarquable. Vous avez une mise à jour régulière, non seulement des travaux de la Fondation, mais des travaux des anciens boursiers. Le prix international, et c'est ceci qui nous réunit ce soir, qui est décerné chaque année à un chercheur du plus haut niveau international dans les disciplines, évidemment, soutenues par la Fondation. Et nous avons eu ces trois dernières années, en 2015, le professeur Roger Lehmann pour ses travaux dans le domaine du contrôle neuronal de la main. En 2016, le professeur Jan Oder pour ses travaux dans le domaine de l'archéologie et de la complexité sociale. Et en 2017, le docteur Joël Fagot, que je vois ici, sur la cognition du primate non humain. Donc pour clore cette introduction, je tiens à remercier les fondateurs, monsieur et madame Fissette, qui nous permettent d'avoir toujours aujourd'hui, après 40 ans, cette action dans tous ces domaines. Et nous leur rendons hommage ce soir en participant à cette cérémonie. Je vous remercie aussi tous d'être présents pour la remise de ce prix à Sylvia Harbour. Et je vais passer la parole à Sonia Garel, qui va nous présenter ses travaux.
Alors, bonsoir à tous. Monsieur le Président de la Fondation FICEN, mesdames et messieurs les membres du Conseil d'administration et du Conseil scientifique, chers amis, chers collègues, mesdames, messieurs. Donc, comprendre comment les circuits sont formés par des neurones dispersés et permettre de contrôler toutes les fonctions innombrables et assez fascinantes du cerveau est vraiment un rêve pour tout neurobiologiste. Et en passant du développement à la physiologie, en alliant élégance conceptuelle et expérimentale, Sylvia Harbour a permis d'établir les liens entre la construction des circuits moteurs, leur architecture fonctionnelle et les comportements qu'ils contrôlent chez l'animal. Sylvia Harbour est une chercheuse d'exception et c'est un grand plaisir de rendre hommage ce soir à ses contributions majeures. Donc, pour reprendre l'historique, tout d'abord, elle a montré comment les axones sensoriels peuvent se connecter avec des sous-populations très spécifiques de neurones. Elle a utilisé pour cela de manière tout à fait magistrale la génétique de la souris et elle a identifié des programmes transcriptionnels, mais aussi neurotrophiques, qui régulent l'assemblage des circuits réflexes. Ces travaux ont permis de mettre en évidence des principes fondamentaux qui régissent le câblage des circuits, non seulement dans la moelle épinière, mais également dans tout le système nerveux. Dans un deuxième temps, Sylvie Arbor a remonté le long des circuits moteurs, depuis la moelle épinière, le tronc cérébral et enfin jusqu'aux circuits centraux. Et cette progression a été possible grâce au développement du traçage transsynaptique qui utilise des formes modifiées du virus de la rage, une technique qui a été améliorée vraiment jusqu'à la perfection dans son laboratoire. Grâce à cet outil unique, elle a été l'une des premières à faire la caractérisation fonctionnelle de l'organisation des circuits prémoteurs, qui sont formés par des petits noyaux et des petits groupes de neurones dispersés. En combinant ces approches avec d'élégantes méthodes de dissection comportementale, elle a vraiment pu montrer les rôles précis de ces sous-populations de neurones dans la réponse motrice et les réponses comportementales. Enfin, Sylvie Arbor, en continuant sa progression, a montré comment ces circuits cérébraux, notamment ceux qui contrôlent la peur, peuvent réguler la réponse motrice pour construire un comportement adapté au contexte de l'animal ou de l'individu. Donc tous ces travaux extrêmement innovants ont vraiment permis de décrire pour la première fois, à l'échelle cellulaire et synaptique, des circuits qui étaient jusque-là méconnus, de disséquer leurs fonctionnalités et la manière dont ils s'imbriquent avec d'autres circuits pour construire tout le répertoire des réponses motrices dont l'animal est capable. Donc toutes ces études sont publiées dans des revues les plus prestigieuses et ont eu un impact considérable dans tout le domaine des neurosciences. Sylvie Arbor, grâce à son esprit aiguisé et synthétique, une approche en même temps systématique et créative, une capacité de développer des nouveaux outils, des cadres conceptuels, de partager ces outils avec la communauté, est aujourd'hui une spécialiste mondiale dans l'analyse des circuits. Alors, on pourrait penser que je parle de quelqu'un qui va bientôt prendre sa retraite. Mais bien sûr, elle poursuit sa progression et son travail tout à fait pionnier. Et il est certain qu'elle continuera à écrire de nombreux et nouveaux chapitres dans l'histoire de la neurobiologie et des neurosciences. Pour toutes ces raisons, au nom de la Fondation Fissen et de mes collègues du Conseil scientifique, j'ai l'immense plaisir de vous présenter le professeur Sylvie Arbor, qui a reçu le prix international de la Fondation Fissen 2018, consacré au thème « Architecture des circuits neuronaux, des synapses à la cognition ».
Alors, je vais passer maintenant la parole à Sylvie Arbor, qui va nous présenter ses travaux. Et j'avoue que j'ai oublié de lui donner ses titres au départ. Donc, Sylvia est professeure de neurobiologie au Biocentrum de l'Université de Bâle. Et elle dirige également un groupe de recherche au Friedrich Miescher Institute for Biomedical Research à Bâle. Donc, c'est une de nos cousines suisses, mais qui parle surtout pas français.
Un petit peu.
Merci, Sylvia.
Merci beaucoup. Cher président de la Fondation Fissen, chers membres du conseil d'administration et du conseil scientifique, chers collègues, mesdames et messieurs, je souhaite tout d'abord remercier sincèrement la Fondation Fissen et en particulier le conseil scientifique pour m'avoir sélectionné pour ce prix international de la Fondation Fissen. Recevoir ce prix est un grand honneur, non seulement à titre personnel, mais aussi pour toute mon équipe, dont les membres ont très largement contribué au développement de notre domaine de recherche. Nos travaux scientifiques portent sur l'organisation et le rôle des circuits neuronaux impliqués dans le contrôle moteur, Le mouvement est l'expression la plus apparente de l'activité globale du système nerveux. Mais de façon surprenante, l'identité précise des circuits permettant de générer et moduler l'extraordinaire diversité du répertoire moteur reste mal comprise. Je voudrais maintenant vous présenter nos dernières découvertes sur cette question aussi fascinante que fondamentale. Et pour cette raison, je vais maintenant continuer en anglais pour la suite de la présentation. Si ça va bien. Merci beaucoup.
It's a great pleasure to be able to talk to you tonight about some of our recent work on understanding the circuits that control how we move. As was already mentioned in the very generous introductions to my work, one of the main fascinations in studying the control of movement is the realization that we can move in many different ways. Yet we understand very little about the organization of the nervous system that leads to these diverse actions. Let me begin with an example. Many of our actions are in fact regulated or induced by some sort of sensory inputs. This is one of my heroes. He happens to come also from Basel and plays tennis extremely well. But also for all of you, many movements that you carry out start with sensation. There are different senses that impinge on the nervous system. In case of Roger Federer, the main sense here is vision. These senses are processed through sensory input streams of a variety of kinds, and these sensations are integrated and processed within the brain, and they ultimately lead to diverse motor actions. Now, you may know that for the sensory systems, the organization is quite well understood. It's actually very well understood how individual sensory neurons connect to the first steps into the nervous system and what are the molecules that drive these processes. In contrast, it has remained largely ununderstood how the other end of the nervous system is organized to orchestrate the diversity of actions. And this has been our field of study, to try to understand the circuit organization that leads to action diversification. So, in our lab, we mostly study circuits that regulate body movements. So how to move your body? You need to activate the muscles of your body, and this is taken from a review we recently wrote together with Rui Costa. And so at the end of the day, the way you move your body is by motor neurons in the spinal cord that innervate your skeletal muscles and that lead to execution. However, these circuits cannot do anything without instructions from the brain. And so you can understand this very well if you think of someone who has a complete spinal cord injury. That person is paralyzed, even though the circuits in the spinal cord are still perfectly functional. Inputs from the brain on what to move and how to move are missing. On the other end, you have a lot of knowledge about the upper circuits that control action choice and action planning. But what's been missing is to understand how these action plans transmit in the selection of the right actions. And this is where we have been making quite some progress recently, to understand how these action choices are linked to the execution by the selection of the right command lines. As Sonia mentioned, one of our entry points that has been very fruitful was to use a modified version of a rabies virus. And this virus had been modified by Ed Calloway's team some years ago, no longer to be very toxic, and instead express a fluorescent protein that allows the visualization of neurons beautifully. So what we thought is to have an entirely fresh look at the organization of neurons in the brain that have axons and connections to circuits in the spinal cord to see where are these neurons anatomically, where are they localized. The other thing about this virus is that actually this virus stops at the first synapse. So while a wild-type rabies virus, when you get bitten by a dog with the rabies virus, will ruin your nervous system by jumping through many synapses, this virus will stop after one jump. And so we made use of this by actually injecting it into muscles of the forelimb and muscles of the hind limb with different colors, and then visualizing where in the brain are the neurons located that drive these motor neurons. Why did we do this? We reasoned that if there is an anatomical trace of the differential functions of forelimb and hind limbs, then we might have an entry point here to visualize these neurons. And as you know, forelimbs and hind limbs are very different. You use your hands to do precision skills. You write, you type, you play the piano. With your legs, on the other hand, you are much less skilled. They're used for locomotion. And this is evolutionarily conserved. Also, mice use their forelimbs for skilled movements. So we can use the mouse as a model system to reveal these circuits. So let me show you a three-dimensional model of where these neurons are located in the brain when we do these tracing experiments. So this is now a digitalized version of the brain, where you can see in pink, every dot here is a neuron cell body that connects to forelimb motor neurons, and in blue you see the ones that connect to hind limbs. And this model you can actually rotate in three-dimensional space, giving you an impression of how complex the neuronal composition is of neurons in the brain that connect to motor neurons in the spinal cord. And you can also see already in this just very simple reconstruction that there are domains where one color is overrepresented. And this means that there are areas in the brainstem that we can clearly already from this very overview analysis see that are more preferential for one or the other type of neurons. So when we looked at these neurons in more detail and actually mapped them into the different areas of the brainstem, we found that we could indeed subdivide them into three different categories. We found one category that was highly selective for forelimbs. So that would be anatomically driving only forelimb motor neurons. We found also another category that would be more biased toward hind limbs. And then we found a third category that we found to actually connect to both forelimbs and hind limbs. And these neurons, you can imagine, as neurons that sit on top of your spinal cord, have a very long axon and make collateral along the way everywhere. So they broadcast the information throughout the entire spinal cord. And what I'll be showing you now is some work that we've done recently to do some functional work on these neurons. And beautifully, I think, the anatomical prediction of how these neurons are connected matched very nicely with function. We found that some of the neurons that have these long-range projections around the spinal cord are actually needed to perform full-body actions, such as locomotion, where your entire body is in action. Whereas the neurons that are forelimb-specific in terms of anatomy also seem to have very dedicated function in the control of different aspects of forelimbs. And I would now like to show you these two types of movement possibilities and try to convince you that indeed there are dedicated neuronal populations that are responsible for diverse actions, selectively responsible. And I would like to start with the part on locomotion. So I'll show you some of our published work on a identification of neurons that are involved in specific aspects of locomotion. So historically, people that studied locomotion performed experiments where they would take cats, historically, they would take cats and they would put stimulation electrodes in different regions of the brain of the cat and stimulate and see which stimulations would elicit locomotion of the cat. And so some key structures were identified, including an area called mesencephalic locomotor region. But surprisingly, in the more caudal region of the brainstem, there was a lack of being able to identify such regions. And that was very surprising because it was known that this caudal region was absolutely essential for locomotion, and nevertheless, electrical stimulation did not elicit the effects. So what had been proposed now quite some time ago is that that might be due to neuronal diversity. And so these upstream motor centers act through the reticular formation, then in turn connect to spinal cord circuits. And the reason why one may not be able to actually stimulate these regions and elicit locomotion could be neuronal diversity. So indeed, in a study that is already published, so I will only summarize it in two slides, we found that it really matters to dissect the neurons at the level of subtypes. And it's just not sufficient to look at an area, but you actually need to look at the cells and subdivide them by function. So what we found is that in this caudal region of the brainstem, the one that I described to have the broadcasting axons, when we stimulate in any one of sub-regions of these regions, this is getting a bit complicated, but this is essentially the roadmap of the brain when you take the atlas, and they have all they are subdivided in different names. So it's like when you take a map and you just look at different cities. Okay, but within the city then, you have actually different areas, sub-regions, and you have different houses. And so what we found is that it really matters to look inside this area to actually identify the type of neuron that does something. So in any one of the four regions that had been implicated in locomotion before, if we now use modern type of activation in an unbiased manner, so if we activate optogenetically the neurons in these regions, we also do not induce locomotion. So that's totally compatible with what had been published before in cats. However, once we subdivide the neurons into excitatory and inhibitory neurons that are actually intermingled in these regions, we can elicit very different effects. The surprising thing was, though, for locomotion, there was only a very tiny region called LPGI. In this region, we were able to very reliably induce locomotion in mice. And so I'll show you just a quick movie here. Whenever you see the on coming on is when we stimulate these sets of neurons. And you should be able to see that the mouse, when it's stationary and the stimulation of the neuron gets switched on, the mouse initiates locomotion. So this is like a switch to initiate locomotion, and it's highly reliable. Now, within this region that is inducing locomotion, there are also intermingled inhibitory neurons that express VGAT, and we can therefore tag them and express the optogenetic activator in these neurons. So what do we find there? So interestingly, the activation of the inhibitory neurons in any of the four regions here leads to behavioral arrest. So I'll show you two movies on this. And again, this is behavioral arrest. If you just look at full body locomotion and ask what is the mouse doing after stimulation, you will see that the mouse stops. But the kind of stopping that the mouse does looks very different depending on in which region we stimulate. So when we stimulate inhibitory neurons in this region, LPGI, we get behavioral stalling, whereas if we stimulate in a slightly neighboring region called GIV, we get body collapse. And I'll show you these movies so you can convince yourself. So this is the area, the LPGI area. You can see the mouse is locomoting, and whenever we switch on the light, the mouse just stops. So we can essentially switch on the excitatory neurons to initiate locomotion and switch on the inhibitory neurons to stall locomotion. Now, when we stimulate the neurons that are in the GIV region, the mouse also stops, but it essentially collapses the body. It's a very different way of stopping. And we think that these are the neurons that are active when you sleep. So when you sleep and dream, you are not acting out your dreams, and you need to essentially shut down your motor system. And these are those neurons that essentially allow you to dream without doing anything. So you can see that these neurons have a very different property than the ones that would be active during normal behavioral stalling. So this work then showed that anatomically identifying neurons that have axons that run throughout the entire spinal cord and broadcast information as one example of actually regulating full body parameters, full body locomotion. Now I would like to switch and show you that there are other neurons in the brainstem that are needed for very, very different things, namely specific types of forelimb specific behaviors. Now, if you Google mouse or rodent forelimb behavior, you will find a variety of different movies. And this is reminiscent of also what we would do with our forelimbs. We do many different things with our forelimbs, so it's not just a simple motor program. You can see that mouse eating and holding what it's eating, taking care of the pups, cleaning itself. For this, you need the forelimbs, and this is without moving the entire body, what I was showing you before. So clearly, you would need a very different neuronal substrate to orchestrate these types of movements than for locomotion. And so the neurons that we had identified anatomically would perhaps be a good entry point for us. Now, historically, people had attributed these types of complex and skilled behaviors to cortical regions. Nevertheless, if you read the literature carefully, in rhesus monkeys, it was shown that if you cut the pyramid, which is the tract that goes from the cortex to the spinal cord, these monkeys can actually reach and they can hold food with forceps and they can grasp it still. So that means clearly the cortex as cortex is not needed for these types of skills. It might be needed to transmit to lower level circuits, but for the execution it's not needed because in the monkey here the axons that go to the spinal cord are cut. And that already makes a strong case for neurons that are subcortical that actually regulate forelimb movements. In our initial work, we had identified already these MDV neurons in the medulla being essential for skilled forelimb movements, and in particular for the grasping movements. So in mice in which these excitatory MDV neurons are ablated or silenced, had difficulties grasping. They didn't have any other phenotypes in full body locomotion or reaching or retraction, but a very selective defect in grasping. Now, we were interested to actually dissect this forelimb network in more detail, and one way you can do this these days is to use optogenetic technology to visualize the behavior that you elicit by stimulating different neurons. And so we went in and stimulated the areas that we had found anatomically with a lot of precision. And one subregion in the brainstem that gave very beautiful results was a small subregion of an area called PCRT. And you see here, this small region here was very strongly, if you activate these neurons, the glutamatergic neurons, would initiate a reaching behavior. So this mouse, a similar number of neurons stimulated as for the locomotion animal, but this mouse does not locomote, but it carries out a unilateral reach. So this is optogenetics and, you know, somewhat artificial. Then the question is, are these neurons really also active when the mouse carries out such tasks? So what is the activity of PCRT neurons during forelimb behaviors or other behaviors? Is this compatible with our model? So we actually went in and recorded in freely moving mice in these caudal brainstem regions with silicon probes. And then the beauty about these recordings is that you can keep the units for a few hours, if you're lucky, and you can carry out different behaviors with these mice, keeping the same units and then asking when is that unit active. So for skilled four-limb behaviors, the type of behaviors we do are two are shown here. One is very similar to what we're going to do after this lecture. We're going to go and grab some pieces of food to eat. In this case, we have put the mouse in a plexiglass box. There's a slit, and we present it with some food pellet or chocolate pellets that the mice can reach. In the other case, this is a lever-pressing task where the mouse can learn to press the lever several times, and then it runs to collect a reward for having done that properly. And you can compare these four-limb tasks with, for example, how the mouse is running around in the cage or how the mouse is running to get the reward and ask whether the neurons are active during running, during lever pressing, or during the food pellet retrieval. And then you can align the trials to a certain starting point of the behavior. So what you see here is several different trials of one example neuron that is a representative unit. Each line here is an activity event of the neuron, and it's aligned to the end of the arrival phase at the lever, and then it starts to reach. And with this unit, what you can see is that this unit is highly active in the beginning phase of the reaching. And so this is very nicely compatible with the work we've shown, the optogenetic stimulation inducing reaching. Now, if we take a single unit and we look across behaviors, what do we see? So interestingly, if you compare a unit during lever pressing compared to pellet reaching, we find that this same unit usually has an activity peak around the same time. But if that same unit, you monitor that same unit during walking, so when the mouse is locomoting, it's completely silent. And this means in the brainstem, you have task-specific neurons. So even though for walking, you will use the same muscles as you will use for reaching, you have an instructive signal in the brainstem that instructs these neurons to either walk or reach and grasp. So the selection of the appropriate command neurons in the brainstem is essential to carry out the right action with the muscles. Now, I just showed you a few example units, but if you align all the units that, or many of the units that we have recorded from, one thing that emerged is that, you know, not all neurons are actually active exactly at the reaching onset. So what you see in these plots is essentially aligning the highest mean firing rate across the different units. And you can see time zero is the beginning of the reaching, as in the other plots. And you can actually see that some units are active long time before the onset, and others are active after. So this means this is actually a whole spectrum of activity patterns. And it called for the question to ask whether these neurons still are not a unique population, but maybe are composed still of subsets of neurons that might be doing different things. So how could these PCRT neurons that show different activity patterns, but all related with the forelimb movements, how could they implement this? And so one way to get at this was to ask, what are the output structures of these neurons? So where are these neurons projecting to? And they actually found that there are three main targets of this area. And so I'm showing you here a scheme. So essentially, when we start in the PCRT, we found that in the PCRT, the neurons project, on the one hand, to the cervical spinal cord. This is how we identified them. Secondly, they also had a very nice termination zone in the medulla, which is where the MDV neurons would be located. And they had another termination zone on the contralateral side. Now, the question was, is a single neuron projecting to all three of these sites, or are these different neurons? And so we can use retrograde viruses to trace them in different colors and ask what is the overlap between the neurons. So there are two experiments that I show you here because they're just dual injections. In experiment one, we inject medulla and spinal cord. And in experiment two, we inject spinal cord and contralateral PCRT. And the result of these experiments was very clear. Namely, each of these targeting populations are actually different neurons. So a single neuron projects either to the spinal cord or the medulla or to the PCRT. So even though we're all in PCRT, you have essentially three lines that go to different sites. It's not a single neuron that projects to all of these regions. And still, when you look where are the neurons located, so in these reconstructions, each dot is a neuronal cell body, they are intermingled. So you're in an area, again, that is highly intermingled in space, and you have neurons that project to different positions, to different regions. So then the question is whether these anatomically distinct PCRT populations that we can stratify by their projection target, do they have different functions, or are they all doing the same thing? So again, we used optogenetics, but now we could tag them based on their projection pattern. And I'll show you first a movie of spinally projecting PCRT neurons. So we essentially retrogradely labeled them from the spinal cord. And you can see here that the number of neurons is actually very small now. We only have 200 neurons. And if we activate those 200 neurons that sit right on top of 7N, this is the behavior that you elicit. So it's a very confined behavior with the ipsilateral forelimb, and you actually initiate a reaching behavior. And when you carry out EMG recordings, so measure the activity of the muscles that move the forelimb, the pattern that you induce is similar to the natural behavior, namely the biceps is active before the triceps and the contralateral muscles are inactive. Now, how does it look like if we activate medulla projecting neurons? And here is where I think gets really, really interesting. So in this case, we are retrogradely labeling the neurons from the medulla, which is the even more caudal region of the brainstem. And then we are bringing in the optogenetic activator in the PCRT. And initially, we were very confused by the results we got because essentially every mouse had a different behavior. And so we thought, what's going on? But the striking thing was that when we had a mouse that was doing one behavior, it would consistently do that same behavior over and over again on the same day, on the next day, 1 week later. It would stick to this behavior. So as if we were activating a particular ensemble that was able to program the neurons to do a certain behavior. Now, the types of behaviors I'm going to show you by movie because they're really quite amazing. Similar number of neurons activated. Sometimes we get tapping. Another time we get grasping, we can get grooming, we can get eating and handling, and all of these neurons are located in the PCRT. And so we think that they are probably the way we activate them, the ensemble that is dominant, will give rise to this behavior. Let me show you the movies. So this is a mouse that we would call a grasping mouse. You can see that it's moving the fingers, it's closing the fingers, and it's very different from the reaching, just simple reaching we have seen before. This movie here is a mouse that we call the tapping mouse. It's almost like a drumming mouse with one hand. Very different from the grasping. This is a mouse we call eating and handling. You see, the mouse does not have any food. But it's opening the mouth and it's trying to put something in the mouth. So this is initiating a program that it would do if it was eating something, but it's not eating anything. And the last movie I'll show you here is the grooming. So again, these are neurons in the same region. Behaviors stick with the mouse over days, but they are different. They can be different between different mice. So we think this is really interesting because it allows you to actually diversify movements. So many of the four-limb behaviors require initiating, essentially transporting the hand to somewhere. But then you need to do different things with the hand. So the reaching, in a sense, the only information that the reaching has is to bring your hand somewhere in space. You need to have the directionality, where in space do I want to go? But then what you do with the hand, there are many different options. And we think that these different options come about by different populations of PCRT neurons that talk to different downstream neurons in the medulla. And this is what we were revealing with the optogenetic experiments that we did. So I would just like to end on one slide to say that, of course, not all of the action happens in the brainstem. Just to zoom out again a bit and to illustrate what we're up to now, we have, I think, pretty good evidence that the command lines for diverse actions sit in the brainstem. And we are now trying to figure out how it is that certain command lines are selected so that you carry out one action, but you don't carry out, you do not do any one of the other 100 or 1,000 actions that you could do. You need to repress all of these. And so that's something that's very likely done by the combination of basal ganglia and cortical inputs, and that we're working on now to try to figure out how all of this works. And last but not least, I would very much like to thank my team that over the years has contributed to this work. The work I talked about today on locomotion was carried out by Paolo Capelli, Chiara Pivetta, and Soledad Esposito actually initiated the brainstem projects when she was in my lab. She now has her own lab in Argentina, and Marcus Sigrist. For the four-limb motor control project, that was done initiated by a PhD student, Ludwig Ruder, is carried out together now with Chiara, Ricardo, and Sarah. And this work that I told you about in the last half of the talk is not published yet and still work in progress. And I would also take the opportunity one more time to very much thank the Fondation FISEN for this award today. It's been really a great honor to receive this award. Thank you very much for your attention.
J'espère que vous avez tous été aussi fascinés que moi par cette splendide dissection de ces comportements, qu'on pouvait penser très simples ou très cérébraux, et que tu as montré si élégamment dans le tronc cérébral. Comme nous sommes un peu en avance, n'est-ce pas ? Je me dis que peut-être on pourrait prendre des questions si certains veulent en poser. Moi, par exemple, je me demandais si ces circuits sont dès le départ ou est-ce qu'ils sont appris pendant l'enfance du petit raton. Qu'est-ce que tu en penses?
So we don't know. It's a very interesting question. All the tracing experiments and the functional experiments are done in the adult, but we know very little about how they develop. It's very difficult to do tracing in the developing mouse, as it is to study humans. But, you know, it's very interesting. What one knows is that not all neurons from the brainstem project at the same time to the spinal cord. So I think there is a sequence. The other thing that one needs to take into consideration is the, you know, essentially plasticity mechanisms and pruning. I mean, for the cortex, for example, it's known that when it projects to the spinal cord, it's projecting way more targets than later. So there's some pruning going on. And that may have to do also with learning motor tasks.
Because I was especially thinking to the Rett syndrome, in which you have this behavior with the hands, and they have first correct development, it's little girl, and after that they have this mental retardation that appear, and this very particular. So do you have any ideas of how to explain whether
I think what one would have to do is take the mouse model and then perhaps mutate, in particular regions of the brainstem to see whether these symptoms, the motor symptoms, can be attributed to some of the brainstem regions, because obviously there are also other symptoms. But surprisingly, and I didn't put in this slide, but many of the diseases of the nervous system, almost all, have motor, you know, you can see it, how the people move. Even purely cognitive these disorders, you can see what the people have.
Est-ce que quelqu'un a... Oui.
Did you try to stimulate at the same time two different locations to try to get conflict between, for example, grooming and reaching?
Yeah. Yes. So we haven't done these types of experiments, but that's certainly one thing we would like to do. But what, you know, what we have tried is to stimulate. For the locomotion, we have stimulated the LPGI region as a whole, and there we didn't get anything. So the reason why we didn't get anything, we think, is that they cancel each other out. So there's probably the endogenous circuitry is because you will never want to walk and stop at the same time. So if you activate both of them at the same time, you're just not doing anything. So it'll be very interesting. But on the other hand, it's a bit, you know, you can do tons of these optogenetic experiments, but then the question is, what does it really mean? Because they're kind of artificial. You know, if you stimulate hard enough the locomotion center, you're probably going to override the grooming. If you stimulate the locomotion center very lowly, you're probably going to override it with the grooming. And then what do you learn? So we're kind of going more the way upstream and trying to see what are the inputs and how do they how does it work naturally.
Quelqu'un a une autre question, Sonia?
So fantastic. So in terms of natural behavior that you're exploring, is there a way to dissect out sequences? Because you've identified the tapping and the grasping and everything, and we can imagine that basically you could dissect out in some sort of sequences as well, following very specific behavior. So is this something that we can do in mice, mm-hmm. In a more natural environment, and try to have some sort of sequences of motor behavior?
Yes. So the sequences is always a question of how, what do you call an element of a sequence, right? So in the assay I showed you with the lever pressing, you could say one lever press is a part of the sequence. But you could also take the view if you do a reaching, grasping, and retrieval, the reaching is the first part of the sequence, the grasping, and then the retrieval. So it is a bit tricky with these sequences. But, you know, I think what people have studied as sequences in the basal ganglia is more this repetitive stuff, right? Let's say four-time lever pressing. I initiate a lever press, but then keep going, and then essentially initiate another sequence of four lever presses. But that's also not very natural. So I don't know. I mean, all the assays in lab animals are unfortunately not very natural because they need to be stereotyped. And that's why we got so interested in these forelimb results, because it's the first time we actually see that there is actually a diverse array of different behaviors, because most people studying forelimb actually study reach, grasp, retrieve. It's like a, you know, but then if you look at what kind of a repertoire do we have, it's enormous. But, and that's the interesting question. How do you get this enormous repertoire? Not just, well, you know, it's a beginning to understand how reach, grasp, retrieve works, but there is many more questions to explore there.
Thank you very much for this fantastic talk. Do you see evidence for control of individual digits, or is there only movement of the entire hand?
Yes. So far we have only seen movement of the entire hand. And we're getting now into this deep learning, deep lamp cut analysis that allows to track more finely. But by just looking at the movies with high resolution, we have not seen single finger movement. But in the mouse, you would not expect it. I was asked once whether we can make the mice play piano, so I think we cannot.
So Sylvia, so here you activate the sequence with light, but in normal life, so in regular life, you think that it's not the cortex from what you said, so it will be cerebellum that gives the instructions? Where does it come from?
Yes. So in normal life, we don't get this like repetitive tapping. But in normal life, you also don't activate all the neurons at the same time, right? But the cerebellum is a very interesting topic on its own. I think that the cerebellum output probably is for these brainstem neurons. By the way, they get very interesting patterns from the DCNs. They probably are there to adapt. You know, if you have a deviation, you need to quickly be able to adapt. And the cerebellum compares what you are going to do with what you have done. And if your expectation, well, what you expect doesn't match with what you have done, like you stumble over something, you need to do a quick adjustment of your motor program. That's probably where the cerebellum comes in. But I don't know whether they would be drivers. So we have a project on DCNs and their connections to the brainstem. So we'll see how that goes.
In what you presented, there are certain things that are bilateral, such as locomotion has to be bilateral. Yeah. The grooming with four limbs is mm-hmm. bilateral. Mm-hmm. The reaching was unilateral each time. Is there a difference in structure between what's unilateral or bilateral? Yeah.
There is an anatomical difference. And surprisingly, I failed to point this out. When we induce locomotion, we only stimulate on one side. So you actually initiate the full locomotor program with stimulating one side. And it can be explained by the way how these neurons project to the spinal cord. They are fully bilateralized. So if you look at where the synapses terminate, they terminate on both sides. So if you had a stroke on one side, you could probably still induce locomotion in these patients. Whereas the anatomy of the forelimb neurons that do the unilateral thing, they are essentially unilaterally projecting to the spinal cord, so they don't go to the contralateral side. For grooming behaviors, that will be very interesting. That's why initially we were very excited to see this contralateral projections of the PCRT. We don't know yet what that's doing, but clearly there are some neurons in the brainstem that cross the midline, and that'll be very interesting to study that. Yes, because we do many things with two hands, but other things we do only with one hand. And you know, then there comes the question for humans. We do things better with one hand. Mice also, 50% are right-handed, 50% are left-handed. What is the origin of that? It's, as to my knowledge, it's not known. I don't think it's at the level of the brainstem, but that's an interesting question too.
Peut-être une dernière question qui nous sépare du cocktail.
Seems the organization of the neurons in the brainstem is quite remarkable, so that they are so intermingled in different types. Do you think there's an advantage to this organization? Mm-hmm. Does it have something to do with local inhibition or like network organization?
Yes, that's a very interesting question too, that we wonder often, why would you have all of these neurons in the same region? I mean, one, you know, hand-waving explanation could be that the upstream inputs would come to these regions that deal with forelimb movements and give information to some of the neurons specifically. And it's also a way, possibly, how you could adjust the motor programs by synaptic plasticity. If you're there and you just change some local synapses, you can become better in one or the other forelimb movement. But that's completely speculative, right? I mean, it's a way to compartmentalize, but at the same time have a high degree of specificity. I mean, you know, similar things are existing in the cortex, right? Where, for example, visual neurons have very specific properties, but they are still specific. And you could also say, why do they need to be all in one place? You know, it's interesting, but we don't have an answer.
Merci beaucoup, Sylvia. Je voudrais qu'on applaudisse encore pour.
Merci beaucoup à tous.
Non seulement cette très belle présentation, mais ces réponses aux questions. Et je voudrais à nouveau remercier la Fondation Fissen qui nous permet d'honorer des grands travaux, des grands scientifiques. Et puis, je vous prie d'aller vers la grande galerie pour le cocktail. Et je vous rappelle aussi que vous pouvez visiter les galeries de l'évolution. Donc, profitez-en. Merci beaucoup. ça. Merci.